Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to the Children's Justice Project monthly training series. This training is offered to key stakeholders involved in Wyoming's juvenile court system and held every second Tuesday of the month from 12 to 1 p.m. To obtain the materials electronically for today's training, please visit the Children's Justice Project website at www.courts.state.wy.us/initiatives/CJP and then click the training tab in the middle of the screen. If there are any questions, participants are welcome to call in during the last 10 minutes of the training session. The call-in number is area code 917-889-8064. One may also post questions and comments using the online chat session on the Blog Talk Radio website. We hope you'll find today's training informative and would like to thank you for your attendance.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Edie Troutwine, your host for this afternoon. I am the Children's Justice Project Coordinator with the Wyoming Supreme Court. And today's episode of Blog Talk Radio is titled Adverse Childhood Experience Study: Understanding Childhood Trauma and How Past Experiences Shape Behaviors and Health Outcomes. Today's episode will be presented by Dr. Jennifer Davis. She is with the Wyoming Children's Trust Fund. Her presentation will be about an hour. And again, it will focus on Adverse Childhood Experience Study, otherwise known as ACES. And some of the key objectives will be providing a discussion about how we stereotype behaviors in children and adults, describe the ACES research and how it pertains to Wyoming families, discuss what to look for in high-risk behaviors, discuss early brain development, and describe the different stress responses, and also discuss how we look at prevention and interaction, and discuss how we change our outlook for families of need and support. Dr. Davis has provided two handouts for today's presentation. One is a PowerPoint presentation, and the other is an ACES questionnaire. And both of those handouts can be downloaded off the CJP website. And with that, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Jennifer Davis, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Edie. As Edie said, we're going to be discussing the Adverse Childhood Experiences study today and how it relates to the work that we do here in Wyoming. So we're going to start off by just talking about a few statistics that we have nationally and in our state to just give you an idea of where we're starting looking at the discussion around children who have been victims of maltreatment. In the United States, we have approximately 681 children who are confirmed victims of maltreatment each year, which equates to approximately 14% of our population of children. There are approximately 1,570 children who die as direct relation to child abuse and neglect in our country. And we are spending over $124 billion per year on abuse and neglect, which includes children who are in the child welfare system, also includes medical costs related to any abuse or neglect, mental health services, so it's wide-ranging. Also can equate to some of the incarceration as well. In 2014 in Wyoming, we had 898 victims of substantiated abuse, and 347 of those victims were 5 years old and under. So as we see, we have a third of our children that are being abused are very young. We are spending approximately $1.5 million per month on services for children currently involved in the system, and those are for direct services that are provided to them. So that number, when you equate the other services that are outside of the agency of child welfare, our numbers will be going up in that. The Adverse Childhood Experiences really was an opportunity for us to connect the dots, as I see it. It's really no surprise to any of us that over the years, as you've been doing work with children and families, you know, that experiences that children have in their young years that are negative impact them later in life. So that's been no surprise as this research came out. But what this research really did was connected the dots about how it impacts outcomes later in life and how it directly pertains to outcomes related to incarceration, child welfare, health. It's wide-ranging to really show that this is not a child welfare issue. It really is a systemic societal problem that we need to address in a comprehensive way. So the study took place in the 90s in California. It was conducted by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente, which is a large insurance conglomerate. And what they did was they surveyed 17,000 members of the Kaiser Permanente network that were adults, so they were all over the age of 18, and asked them 10 questions, which is the ACES survey, which was one of the handouts that you were provided. The 10 questions focus on abuse and neglect and household dysfunction. And when you look at the survey, it's very simple. The 10 questions have a yes or no answer. And for every yes that you say on the questionnaire, you get 1 point. So the survey has a potential of a score of 10, and that is really the basis of the survey. Then what they were able to do was look at these scores and correlate it to those members who were seeking health care services through their Kaiser Permanente and were able to make some direct relations related to that. So it really has a dose-response relationship. On the higher the ACEs score, the more significant the health outcomes were for these individuals. And what they found was that two-thirds of the participants had at least an ACEs score of 1, and that 1 in 8 have an ACEs score of 4 or more. And much of the research really leads to the 4 kind of being the tipping point in the ACEs. So scores of 4 or more typically have poorer outcomes in social issues as well as health outcomes. In our country, our average pediatrician will see 2 to 4 children a day that have an ACEs score of 4 or more, which is really significant. So although the survey was first conducted to be done with adults, we know that young children, we can make a prediction based off of what their ACEs score would be on the information that we know already. For children who are entering the system, we often can make a prediction based on what we know at a very early age for those third of our population, 5 years old and under, of kind of where they're headed, even though they're not an adult yet. So what the study also did was really help to connect how we look at abuse and neglect and why it's really important to find out what the underlying issues are for these individuals as we're working with the families. So it was discovered that 80% of young adults who suffered abuse as a child had at least one psychiatric diagnosis by the age of 21. And of those same youth, there was an increased risk of smoking, alcoholism, and drug abuse, as well as an increased incidence of high-risk sexual behavior. So these children were 1.5 times more likely to use illicit drugs, 25% more likely to become pregnant as teenagers and suffer low academic achievement. As juveniles, these individuals, 59% of them had an increased likelihood of arrest. And of that, 28% of those exhibited adult criminal behavior, and 30% of those engaged in violent crimes. There is actually a study that was done that came out in the OJJDP Volume 3 issue in the spring of 14 that looked at Florida did a research study looking at all of their incarcerated juveniles, and they found they had 64,000 approximately juveniles in their system, and they surveyed them with the ACEs score and found that only 2.8% of those that were in the system had an ACEs score of 0. And of those 64,000, they found that over 50% of those individuals had an ACEs score of 4 or more, which is significantly different than the initial study in the early 90s. And they found that these numbers are much higher than what was originally predicted with the first survey. Florida has done a lot of research in their juvenile system to really figure out how to best address these individuals, now having this information that guides their work a little bit differently. And those of you that are following along with the PowerPoint, I am on slide 8, and so we're going to just kind of discuss what some of those risky behaviors lead to. When we look at families, we can look at it from a very early period of time. When we look at these behaviors prenatally, we can see that smoking has an impact, drug and alcohol abuse, stress, and mental illness. Oftentimes, some of these are the children who are born in our hospitals and are removed right away for substance abuse. And we know that from day one, these individuals already are starting to acquire an ACEs score. Postnatally, we know some of the high-risk behaviors are smoking, stress, mental illness, and domestic violence. As we look at the data for Wyoming, for the reason for our substantiations, we found that the majority of the substantiations that are occurring in Wyoming are substance abuse-related, which also combines in with our neglect, which is our highest reason for substantiation in the state, and quite often is drug-related as well. So we also see that the next category in Wyoming for substantiations is domestic violence. So we can see just based on these behaviors that we know that these individuals are at a higher risk of a higher ACE score as well as poor health outcomes as they move through their childhood and into adulthood. So some of the things that they looked at specifically for impacting health were smoking, alcoholism, promiscuity, obesity, drug use. They also looked at relationship problems, marital problems, job performance, and stress. In the mental health area, they saw poor self-related health issues, hallucinations, depression, sleep disturbance, anxiety, poor anger control, sexual health, increased teen pregnancy, increase in fetal death, unexpected pregnancy, early age of first intercourse, and sexual dissatisfaction. And then the major disease processes that a lot of Americans suffer from, such as cancer, liver disease, chronic lung disease, and ischemic heart disease, which is our number one killer in the United States for adults. They saw a significant increase in all of those prevalent disease processes based on the ACEs score, really being that tipping point at 4 or more. And when we start to look at all of these factors, we can really start to look at how does that impact what we do and how do we address these individuals in our system. One example is the state of Alaska in 2008 had the highest infant mortality rate. And so what they did, they have a big ACEs initiative in Alaska, and they decided to combine forces over different agencies and went out into the Alaska bush and had conversations with a lot of the natives across the state and found that a lot of the reason that their infant mortality was high was lack of supports and resources. They were finding that for a 1-hour OB appointment for someone to come in from the bush, it would take them 5 days for a 1-hour appointment. So what they did was they instituted a program where they put basically like health aides into each of the tribal communities, and then they also built neurodevelopmental hospitals with a Ronald McDonald House next to them so women could come in during their pregnancy at whatever period of time so that they could birth there in the hospitals. And what happened was in 2015, Alaska became the number one state for the lowest rate of infant mortality. So with them thinking outside of the box and really addressing what the needs were in the communities, they were really able to move from the worst state in the nation to the best state in the nation for those early deaths, which is really amazing how we can move from those things and impacting a change, as well as they are serving those individuals with the ACEs study and then putting the supports in place while those individuals are in the birthing hospitals to support them as they go back into their communities. The other thing that has come out of this research is really a lot of early brain development, looking at what does stress and trauma do to the developing brain of a child. Again, a third of our children who are abused and neglected are 5 years old and under. So their researcher out of Harvard, which is Jack Shankoff, and he works for the Center of the Developing Child, he has done significant research at looking at the impacts of trauma on brain development. And through his research, what has been found is that as that young brain is developing, the neural connections increase over time as children have more experiences. And what happens as there's repeated trauma in the brain, it actually lays down irregular neural connections. And so they become dysfunctional not only in their architecture, but then how they are actually communicating with each other. And it's really important to intervene early in these children, which we've heard for a very long time. But now there's actual science behind it, realizing why it's so important. By the age of 6, our brain connections start a process which is called pruning. And that is when experiences in our brain that are not utilized repeatedly start to drop off, making way for room for new experiences to be laid down and processed in our brain. So when we have increased dysfunctional patterns happening that our brain is laying down connections for, and those positive connections are minimal, those are what are pruning off, and that is what stays. And those pathways are irregular in their architecture, so it is causing multiple dysfunctional behaviors in young children. So it's very important to understand the science of what happens with that exposure to trauma so that we can intervene early and effectively so we can make a difference. What they also found is that Dr. Shankoff has a quote that says, building the capabilities of adult caregivers strengthen the environment of relationships essential to children's lifelong learning, health, and behavior. The breakdown in reciprocal serve and return interactions between adult caregivers and young children can be a result of many factors. So his research has really shown something that we have all known for a long time, that it really is that reciprocal relationship that young children have with adult caregivers that makes the positive impact. So it's not a one-sided conversation with, you know, a child trying to get attention. When they don't get that reciprocal relationship back, then that is where connections start to break down. So it's so important from day one when the child arrives to have that interaction between a positive adult caregiver so that those connections can be laid down appropriately. And so when we talk about that, the thing that we really need to stress and understand is what actually happens to the body when we are stressed, because we know that the brain architecture changes, but then because of that brain architecture, why are we getting health outcomes that are decreased as well? And that has a lot to do with the stress that's experienced with trauma. And what we find is that when you think about your own experiences of being scared or having long-term anxiety of how it makes you feel internally, that then is what children are experiencing on a daily basis. So, you know, we get that fight or flight reaction where we have hormones increase in our system and our respiratory systems increase, our cardiovascular systems increase, our digestive systems decrease in their function. So quite often what we see even in young children is they have bowel and bladder problems. They may have difficulties with sleeping. All of those things are a direct relation to that sustained chronic stress that they're having based on trauma. Does that mean every child who's experiencing bowel and bladder problems is related to trauma. Absolutely not. But when we put all of the pieces together, it helps lead us down a path where hopefully we can recognize some of these symptoms a little bit earlier in children and do some intervention to help these families get on a different trajectory, hopefully before they even enter the child welfare system. And again, this isn't just a one-time episode. This is children who are repeatedly exposed to trauma and to prolonged stress. And so when we look at a stress response, this becomes really difficult to grade because stress is very subjective. My stress can look very different from anybody else's stress. What stresses me out may not stress another individual. So we have to be really careful not to discount people's perceptions of stress because it's very real for them. And what is happening is it's a very real physiological response that's happening in their body. So again, when people tell us that we're stressed, it's really easy to blow that off if it isn't something that would equate for us. However, we have to be very careful not to do that because it is changing their processes in their body. And so when we look at stress, and through this research that Dr. Shankoff has done, you look at positive stress, which is something that we all experience. That's the positive stress of, you know, getting a paper to your boss that's due, going to, if you're a child, your first soccer game. Those are positive stresses. They're short-term, they go away very quickly, and lots of times there can be a positive outcome from them. A tolerable stress is something that goes on a little bit longer. So a tolerable stress is something that maybe you are building a home, and that is a six-month process. That's stressful when it occurs, but there's still a deadline to it. So you know that there's an ending point to it, and people can tolerate that for a period of time. And then the body can go back to its baseline of homeostasis. But then when we look at toxic stress, that is the stress that goes on and on and on because of the physiological changes in our body. And some of those include like increased levels of cortisol, which increases and causes weight gain, which we know puts additional pressure on our cardiovascular system, our respiratory system, and then over time can lead to that increased rate of ischemic heart disease. And we know that individuals who have higher ACE score, if there is an ACE score of 4 or more, the research has predicted that those individuals will have a 20-year decrease in life expectancy. So there really is a lot of research behind this that puts the science of how we need to be thinking about this differently when we intervene. And so those of you that are following along, just to let you know where I'm at, I'm on slide 15 for those of you that are following through the slideshow. So when we talk about this, we really need to then ask ourselves, what does this mean for us? Okay, we know that there's science behind it. We know that these children that are exposed to trauma early are going to have some difficulties later. But what does it really mean when we look at our practice across different areas? And what it means that is in order to really effectively impact families who are involved in the child welfare system, we need to clearly understand the risks that are involved for early exposure. We need to understand the reason and the science behind intervening early so that we can change those family dynamics and support good, healthy relationships in families before a problem arises. And we know that from research over the years, that the earlier you intervene, the better your outcomes are going to be. And then we also need to understand why children react the way they do. And that is really understanding this information so that we can understand what behavioral changes in children might mean. We talked about the medical end of things, but it's also important to look at the social-emotional impacts on children. So the child who is in preschool or in early elementary school and who's acting out and having behavior issues, in America, we're really quick to diagnose those children with ADD or ADHD, when in fact, maybe that isn't the problem. Maybe it's that this child has an ACE score of 7 and has had significant trauma in that child's life that hasn't been addressed. and intervening in a positive way might reduce the risk of that child needing to go on medication for a diagnosis that doesn't necessarily fit. We've had a significant increase in diagnosis of children on the autism spectrum, which is basically a social-emotional disorder. And are we really looking at that really intentionally to know, is there really something going on social-emotionally with these children, or is there some underlying trauma that we need to address, and how can that look differently? Because it should look differently how we intervene in that. So what we really need to understand is, how do we look at that from a different perspective to get these children the help that they need and the families the help that they need, instead of discounting it very early on as a behavior problem? Because once those children are labeled with that, it follows them for a very long time, and it might not really be the issue that needs to be addressed. So when we look at that information, the World Health Organization has put together a great toolkit that is on their website, that's Preventing Child Maltreatment, A Guide to Action and Generating Evidence. It's a great tool to look at kind of starting to think about that in a different way. And so what do we do with that information then is really how we make a difference. And my opinion of how we make a difference is that we need to take a very honest look at what we're currently doing and compare that to the information that we know and the science. If we can be honest with ourselves and look at how are we addressing these issues to really do some good self-reflection, that can open so many doors for us to do things in a different way. So I think it's really important that as we're working with children and families, that we're taking the time to look underneath that. When we look at substance abuse, it's our number one reason for children coming into care. And so what's the natural thing that we think of is, okay, that family needs to get into substance abuse treatment, which is very true. However, there's a reason that those families are probably using. And if we just address the substance abuse issue and get them to stop, we still haven't addressed the underlying issue. So what when something stresses them again, then that becomes a habitual pattern over time. So we really need to ensure that these people are not only getting referred for substance abuse treatment, but they're getting referred for substance abuse treatment by specialists who know to look at those underlying issues and how do they support them and deal with that trauma so that they then can move through that process of not relying on substances as a coping mechanism. So it's really just thinking about it and taking a slightly different approach to how we look at things. But we have to be willing to look at that from many different perspectives and across many different agencies. As I said in the beginning, this is not a child welfare issue. This really has ramifications across multiple agencies in government as well as at our local levels. There is a doctor named Dr. Gardner who put together a model about how he proposes that we look at these issues really being more of a public health issue as compared to a child welfare issue. And so his model looks at what we're currently doing and then how he believes we should look at it. So this is part of your packet that you have on slide 17 and 18. So slide 17 of his model looks at what he proposes that we're currently doing. And that is looking at our first safety net as universal primary prevention. So primary prevention really looks at prevention strategies that are for everybody in our communities, whether they are high risk or not. These programs should impact everybody. But when we look at what's invested in that across our country, that is a very small net that we're catching individuals on. And then when we look at all of the individuals that fall off of that first net, we see our second net's a little bit bigger, but has a sizable hole in it. And those are really our interventions or our secondary preventions that target those individuals who are at risk. So those that are using substances, those that are living in poverty, those that have mental health diagnosis. These interventions target those individuals. but it isn't used on an individual basis. These are more universal strategies that we're using. Then our third MET, which is where we're investing the majority of our dollars in our country, is in evidence-based treatments. These are the individuals who have fallen off of our prevention nets and landed on our nets where we're needing to intervene very specific for the individual issue, which when they're at that point, it does need to be very individualized. However, we are still losing a lot of individuals through that hole because we aren't always looking at the underlying issue. We quite often put a Band-Aid on it and move children and families through our systems to really look at how do we get them back home, how do we support them with what is the issue currently, but we're sometimes not going back and really looking at what are those underlying issues that need to be addressed in order for that family to move forward in a very functional way and not re-enter into the system. So then when we look at what Dr. Gardner proposes as how we should look at things, he calls it his social-emotional safety net. And this is really based on the public health approach around that toxic stress model. So basically, he reverses our nets. He looks at our universal primary preventions really need to be targeted at our general public and remove any of the stigma attached to them. And when you say prevention, sometimes can even be a problematic word because that insinuates that something's wrong. And in fact, if we're doing good prevention strategies, in fact, that is for everybody. It doesn't necessarily mean that anything is wrong. It means how do we do this well in our communities to support each other? And so this has limited evidence base around it because you're using a primary approach, which all of you probably realize it's difficult to measure primary and secondary preventions because it's longitudinal work that you need to look at, and it's difficult to have a way to track individuals across multiple systems. But if we use that as our first method, as our largest net, we're investing lots of our dollars, we still have a hole there. We have individuals who are going to fall through that. But then they land on our second net, which is our targeted interventions for those at risk, where we get more of an approach that is directed at them with evidence-based services, such as home visitation, like nurse-family partnership, which is for first-time parents that they start intervening at the prenatal period, which we have offered in 11 of our counties in Wyoming through public health. It's getting those children linked into our child development centers that they are at risk, but then there's some supports we can put in place before anything happens. This really requires some screening, and it also has the issues of stigma to it. But if we do a good job there, we're going to catch more children. We're still going to have those ones who fall through, but then we have our smaller net at the bottom that becomes very localized to what these individuals need that we can use our evidence-based treatments for, with our substance abuse treatment, with our mental health treatment, all of those things that we need to do to support those families in being successful. So based on those models, we really need to look at what we're doing and what we know. What we do currently in the United States is we know that 95% of the trillions of dollars that we spend on health is on treatment and not prevention. And what we know is that child abuse and neglect is preventable. If we can switch how we look at things and really take it from a different approach, we can hopefully really make an impact about how we do things. Again, working across different models and different agencies so that we can support each other's work because it can't happen in isolation or we won't be effective with it. And so then how do we really shift then looking at what we do for children and families is by really looking at how do we make that direct shift from an intervention-based philosophy to a prevention-based philosophy. And one of the tools that is out there that has been created is the Strengthening Families Protective Factors Framework. And it is not a curriculum that you follow. It's a framework of looking at really our social determinants of health and well-being. And we look at five different areas that are really comprehensive for families across different sectors. Doesn't matter if you work in the court systems, if you work in correctional facilities, if you work in hospitals, if you work in childcare or in school districts. These apply to everybody about what these frameworks look like. And so when we look at what those frameworks are, they narrowed it down to the five protective factors, which look at parent resiliency, which really looks at how do parents bounce back in time of stress. Are they going to substances in order to cope? How do we give them good coping skills so that when stressors in life arise, which we know they do for everybody, do they have other tools to lean on and use? So that's what parent resiliency looks at. Then we look at social connections. Social connections really look at what are individual social capital that they have. Who do they have in their network that they can relate to and work with that can help them? So if they come into a situation where they can't afford transportation to get to and from the doctor, who do they have to lean on that can help them get there for that? So it's really looking at how do we help people build those connections without enabling them, but empowering them to use those around them. And we have seen a huge social change in our country. For instance, I have lived in my neighborhood for 7 years, and I know my neighbors by name, but I don't really know my neighbors. If I needed something, I could probably go to their home and ask them, but would I feel comfortable with that? In some cases, yes. In some cases, no, because I don't have a good relationship with them. Where previously in lots of our communities, we knew our neighbors well. We talked with them regularly. They were our support system. And a lot of that has changed just based on people's busy lives. But how do we get back to a point where we really help people create that social capital? The next is then knowledge of parenting and child development. This is an area that we know certainly has an impact on child abuse and neglect. We know that children who have developmental delays or disabilities are at a greater risk of child abuse and neglect. And we also know that when parents don't have a good understanding of the expectations of their child at each age, it can also lead to abuse and neglect. So it's really helping parents to understand where their child is at and how to interact with them appropriately so that they can have a great bonding relationship with them that is from a positive perspective. So it's really helping parents to understand that. The next is concrete supports in time of need. That's really our resources. What do we have in our communities to help families? We're in Wyoming. We have a rural population. We don't always have the resources in every community that might be necessary, but it's the responsibility of all of us as professionals to know what those resources are and how to get individuals connected to them. And then we empower them to use them. So that is really important that we look at our communities about what's happening in them and then really investigate what is there and what's needed and ensure that those services become available. And then the last one is social and emotional competence of children, really helping children to understand how to deal with their stress and emotions. And there is quite a few programs out across the country that are evidence-based for very young children all the way up into teenage years. So it's really helping children to develop a system to cope and be able to move through difficult times in their lives, which goes hand in hand with the parental resilience. If parents have good coping strategies, they can pass those on to their children. But when we see a breakdown in that, we really need to be able to help these children understand so that they don't get those labels of ADD or ADHD or on the spectrum or labeled as a behavior problem when, in fact, we can help them process those emotions from a very early age and how to deal with them in a positive manner. So the next few slides that are in your packet just go through some more information of breaking down each one of those protective factors that we just talked about. So you can read through those, and it just gives you a little bit more breakdown of things to look for in each of those categories of the parental resilience, the social connections, the knowledge of development, your concrete support, and then your social emotional competence in children. So it's really important that we work together as communities, because all of our Wyoming communities are different about what they need. And some of the work that the Children's Trust Fund is focusing on is going into communities over this next year and talking with them about what is there, what's lacking, what's there and not being accessed, and why, so that we can really get to what is it that families need in order to be successful in their connections with each other, and what will they actually access to use, because it isn't helpful if we have the wrong programs and projects in our communities that people aren't accessing. Even if they're good, if there's a reason they're not accessing them, then we really need to reevaluate what we need in communities to really help them be successful. So when we look at how do we do that, we're really talking about prevention. And the link between that is really understanding the information around ACEs and trauma, and then really understanding about that early intervention. We know that there is a direct link between children who are in the child protection system to those children that end up in our juvenile justice system that then end up in our adult correctional facilities. So how do we really help from a very early age with supporting these families so that they don't end up, hopefully, in any of those systems, so that they can really be healthy and productive members of our community? And our ultimate goal with that is really preventing children from entering, supporting families, and then ultimately preventing any death of the children that enter our system. So when we look at, there's a really nice public health parable that says, a man by the river hears someone drowning, and being a good swimmer, he rescues the person. Before catching his breath, he hears another in need, and another, and another. He becomes exhausted, and he starts to walk away. So people that are standing around ask, where are you going? And he says, I'm going upstream to prevent others from falling in. And I believe that that's really where we need to be, is upstream. We need those services available when families do end up in the river. That's so very important as well. But if we can get upstream, hopefully we have a whole lot less falling in. So it's really looking at this parable about what can you do as an individual to be that person going upstream, and then what can we do in communities in our state to really embrace that train of thought so that we have less children entering. I mean, our ultimate goal would be to not have children enter the child welfare system, to have a need for that. So in order to get there, we have to work together. The last slide that you guys have is a video, and I would encourage you all to go and watch that. It's a video about a film that came out around the ACEs study that's called Resilience. It's the little trailer of the movie. It's about 3 minutes long and has some really, really great information. Dr. Shankoff is presenting in that. Dr. Nadine Burke, who's a pediatrician out of California that has done a lot of work around the ACEs study, also speaks in that video. She has a great video on YouTube that if you just go onto YouTube and Google Dr. Nadine Burke and ACEs will come up, and it's a 16-minute video, and it is wonderful and talks about the importance of really understanding what the ACEs study is and how it impacts children in our families and how it really changed her thinking as a medical professional to do things differently for children and families. And then the last slide that you guys have in your packet is my contact information. We have an office here in Cheyenne, and so our office number is on there. My cell phone number is also on there, which you're welcome to contact me at, and my email address. The Children's Trust Fund just is getting ready to do a full launch of our website. So right now we have part of it up on the web, so you can go to www.wyctf.org and visit our website. We'll have resources on there, training opportunities. We'll be helping the Department of Family Services launch a neglect campaign across the state. And so there'll be lots of information around that as well. So that is the information that I have related to this topic, and I'd be happy to now open it up if there's any questions that people have.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Davis. And again, the chat room is open, and it also looks like we had someone call in. So if the person calling in has a question, feel free to ask it. Dr. Davis, I had just a question just from a parent's perspective. On your slide number 26, you talk about knowledge of parenting and child development. Can you just give some examples of situations where, you know, people have inappropriate developmental expectations? Or can you talk a little bit more about that, or maybe where to find resources about, you know, what is an appropriate developmental expectation?
Yeah, of course. So I can give you an example of two areas that I've seen a lot of over time. One of the areas is biting. It's a very typical developmental milestone for children to bite. Not a desirable activity, but it is very typical in development. Many times providers as well as parents don't understand that, and we've seen abuse such as parents biting them back and leaving teeth marks on them, drawing blood. Helping parents to understand that that is typical and how to deal with that behavior in an appropriate manner is one example. Another example is potty training. Oftentimes parents will think, you know, my child's 18 months old and it's time to potty train, which is very young for a child to potty train. That typical age for potty training is between the ages of 2 and 3, and helping parents understand that. Oftentimes when kids have accidents in their pants, we've seen abuse around that, them getting too aggressive. And actually doing discipline around that when, in fact, it's a developmental skill that they're developing and isn't something that's punishable for them, especially with aggressive behavior. So looking at those are a couple of examples, and there's lots of resources out there for parents and providers. And we've also seen some of that abuse through child care providers as well of not understanding development either. So there is the Center for the Developing Child, which is through Harvard, has great resources on development. The CDC has great resources that you can Google. In Wyoming here, we have just some direct resources. They can contact the local child development center, which are really our early childhood developmental specialists, and they have lots of resources on development. There is also the home visiting programs through public health and through parents as teachers in the state who can also go into the home and work with parents to help them understand typical development and how to interact with their child appropriately, teaches them what toys to use with them that are appropriate, how to interact. Sometimes we find parents just really don't even know how to sit down and engage in a book with a child. And so that's what our home visiting programs can offer to families as well. So those are a couple of the resources that people could use for that.
That was a wonderful answer. So, well, thank you again, Dr. Davis. And it doesn't look like we have any other questions coming in. And do you have any sort of final comments you want to make or a point you really want to emphasize from today's presentation that you want to leave us with?
What I would leave you with is to just really challenge everybody who's listening today to really reflect on how you're dealing with children and families in your practice, and is there a way that you can do it differently to be more impactful, not meaning that you're doing anything wrong, but we all have room for improvement on how we do things, and just really take the time to reflect on that with the information that you hopefully learned today and see if there's a different way to do it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. And just for folks out there listening, our next Blog Talk Radio will be on February 9th. The title of that episode will be New Federal ICWA Regulations, Indian Child Welfare Act. As many of you might be aware, the ICWA regulations came into effect in December, and we'll have Adrian Smith presenting some information on those new laws. Again, that will be February 9th at noon. So thank you again, Dr. Davis, and with that, we'll go ahead and end today's episode.
Thank you.